The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia's author events series. Tonight we have Camille Dungy here for Soil, the Story of a Black Mother's Garden, in conversation with Aber Lee. I first heard about Camille Dungy back when I was a young thing and I wanted to do a program at Bartram's Garden all about Black nature. What does it mean to have a relationship with nature as a Black person? And I put together a panel, but it was all inspired by Camille Dungy's book, Black Nature, which was published in 2009. It was four centuries of African American nature poem, and it was the poems. And it was the first time ever that someone had created an edition that was all about Black people's relationship to nature. And I want to share one of my favorite poems from that collection. It's by Lucille Clifton. It's called Untitled. Surely I am able to write poems celebrating grass and how the blue in the sky can flow green or red, and the waters lean against the Chesapeake shore like familiar love poems about nature and landscape? Surely. But whenever I begin, the trees wave their knotted branches and, God, there is always another poem under that poem and another poem. So Camille T. Dungy is the author of Guidebook to Relative Strangers, Journeys into Race, Motherhood, and History, a debut personal essay collection that was nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She was also the author of four collections of poetry, What to Eat, What to Drink, What to Leave for Poison, Suck on the Marrow, Smith Blue, and Traffic Cascade, winner of the Colorado Book Award. The editor of three poetry anthologies, Dungy is the recipient of the Guggenheim Fellowship, an Academy of American Poets Fellowship, and an American Book Award. She is an English professor at Colorado State University and hosts the podcast Immaterial, a podcast from the Metropolitan Museum of Art and Magnificent Noise. In Soil, she delves into her seven-year quest to diversify her garden in spite of her community's strict horticultural rules, exposing larger truths about the danger homogeneity poses to our planet. And I hear the Washington Post has just selected Soil as one of the best books for Mother's Day. So write that down. I met Aber Lee through my brother Ryan, and she was at the Longwood program, and she wanted to know, are there other Black people in Kennett Square? And a mutual friend said, yes, there are. I know one, Ryan. But Abra, I'm so grateful to Abra for many, many things, but especially to introducing me to the ladies of our Garden Club of Philadelphia and vicinity. Are the ladies from OGCPV in the house? Yay! All right. Our Garden Club of Philadelphia and vicinity is the oldest Black garden club in North America, and it's here in Philadelphia. What year did it start? 1939, say the ladies. So she... Abra introduced me through all of her garden research to the eminent ladies of OGCPV, and I'm so grateful for that. And whenever I wonder if, you know, I belong in this garden world as a self-taught person, she reminds me, Jamie, you're not new to this. You're true to this. This is in your DNA. This is in your genes. She's right. Aber Lee is a storyteller, horticulturalist, and author of the forthcoming book, Conquer the Soil, Black America and the Untold Stories of Our Country's Gardens, Farmers, and Growers. Gardeners, farmers, and growers, excuse me. She has spent a whole lot of time in the dirt as a municipal arborist and airport landscape manager. Her work has been featured in the New York Times, Fine Gardening, Veranda Magazine, and NPR. Lee is a graduate of Auburn University College of Agriculture and an alumna of the Longwood Garden Society of Fellows, a global network of public horticultural professionals. Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight. Let's have a big hand for Camille Dungy and Aber Lee.
Thank you for the warm welcome, Jamie. Everybody can hear me okay? Okay, wonderful to see so many amazing, beautiful faces in the crowd. And Camille, what an honor and a joy to have you here today. And this is the first stop of your...
The first official stop.
So,
yay, Philadelphia!
Congratulations. So before we get into your book, Soil, The Story of a Black Mother's Garden, I wanted to reiterate something Jamie said. In Philadelphia, being the first stop of this book tour, and her acknowledging the OGCPV, the Our Garden Club of Philadelphia and vicinity, this is the oldest consecutive meeting of black women's garden clubs in the United States, been meeting since 1939. And one of their founders, Harriet Wright Hines, did I get that right? From Philadelphia. But what's interesting, which you may not know, is that one of their former members was a black woman named Bertha Rhodes, whose father started the Philadelphia Tribune, and she had a garden column in the 1940s and 50s for black women. In Philadelphia, also being the home of a garden writer, Effie Lee Newsom, Lena Williams, the essay I showed you. So I feel like this is the best place for you to start.
Perfect.
Your ancestors are in the building tonight. And speaking of place, I think that's a good place for me to start with this book. So you start the book in Fort Collins, Colorado, with your realtor. Mm-hmm. And you're in the car, and you're looking around, and you're talking about the plants that you sent. Everything's so white. And I was also wondering, was it even the setting that you were in that time when you were looking around to see everything, and you were wondering if this was even a good decision to bring your family into this mm-hmm. place?
Yes. So Colorado has blue skies most of the time, but it could also just snow, you know, just any time. July, sure. Why not? Bring on the snow. And in this particular garden tour, it was late May, and the cottonwoods were doing their thing, and a lot of the plants, the hawthorns and the ash and the pear trees, were all finishing their blossoming. And so at that time of year, everything is just coated in these white petals that pile along the margins of the sidewalk and the curbs and on parked cars. And it really does look like there's snow everywhere. And I thought, what am I doing? Both on this practical level, am I going to have bad allergies here? Is it going to be really complicated? You know, that much matter falling from trees gets caught up in gutters, right? It's like actually factually inconvenient, but also it was all very white. Mm-hmm. The town is very white, and we were moving from the Bay Area. My husband grew up in New York, in the Bronx and Queens, and I was about to bring him from Oakland, California, to a place that is just over 1% African American. What's that gonna look like for my family? Are we gonna find a place of welcome in this space? So from the very beginning, there was a factual question about what was growing there, and a really practical question that I had to deal with.
And speaking of place, there, what I took from your book was there's three main places that this a book takes place: Fort Collins, the American West, and also the Prairie Project, which is the name of your garden, this beautiful garden. And by the way, y'all, I meant to say this when I first started. So this book, there is no stone left unturned. Look at this beautiful landscape design of the Prairie Project on the inside, but in the back cover, you get to see how it all turns out. So it's just really extraordinary, the details there, and I just wanted the audience to know that. But to the American West, and speaking of the American West, could you talk about that a little bit for us? Because you mentioned there not being a lot of stories about the Black American West, specifically, I think, as it relates to gardening, and you are very, very right on that. So it was important for you to talk about that region as a whole.
Right. I mean, this is the fact of American popular culture and canonical culture is the very active work of erasing and marginalizing voices that don't fit within a certain very limited perspective. There have been Black people in the American West since the beginning of the settlement of that space, but that those stories are often pushed aside, and often those communities are pushed aside by lack of access to water, that because of where it was that Black towns could establish themselves, it's a desert, the American West is a desert, and often those Black towns sprang up in places where it was harder to access water, and so they didn't persist. Or in places like Denver, urban renewal and freeway projects, and we know this story, right? We hear the story over and over and over again. And so those disappearings of those Black communities. Fort Collins, Colorado, where I live in northern Colorado, has a land-grant institution, one of the older land-grant institutions, and it's got a long history that actually included a number of African Americans. My town was a town that Hattie McDaniels called home for some time during her childhood, and my own great uncle attended Colorado State University when it was and the agricultural and mechanical institution on the kind of educational opportunity that many Black Southerners had to take if there was no PhD granting institution in their home state because of the strictures of the separate but equal idea. They actually the states had to pay for these students to be educated just somewhere else. And so they would go places like Iowa or Colorado or Nebraska or just not Louisiana or Mississippi or Alabama. And so my great uncle attended Colorado A&M in the early 50s. Hmm. So I think when I think about this place that I have made home, I've lived there for 10 years now, and it feels like it's so white, as I described, I am aware of the fact that it is in fact not as limited as that story might seem. And so one of the things that was really important to me in this book was to unearth that connection that I know Black people had in that landscape, this very landscape that I had stumbled onto. And I think that that story happens over and over and over again throughout the U.S., where once you start digging, we show up. Mm-hmm. We're there. And we have kind of always been there. So that felt important. And that feels, I am a child of the American West. That's the landscape. I was born in Colorado. I was raised in California. I now live in Colorado again. It's the landscape I love. It's the place I think of as home. And I wanted in this book, and I want in my life, to really resist the sense that I'm not allowed to call it home, that I'm not allowed to really feel like this is a place where I belong.
And I wanted to speak to the people in the book. So I talked about the three main places of the book: Fort Collins, the American West, and the Prairie Project, which we'll discuss. But the people who continue to come up throughout the book: yourself, beautiful, sweet Callie, your daughter, and your husband, Ray. And you did talk about very early on in the book about reading garden books and mothers, and where were the families in these books, and why it was important for you to include them. So could you speak to that, and why it was important to include your Black family as a part of your garden memoir?
Yeah, and it's reading particularly, not necessarily specifically garden books, but the nature books, right?
Nature.
The nature canon, the environmental canon. And the environmental canon is so frequently you know, when you say that, like an environmental writer, people very, very frequently think that that means like somebody who's gone out tromping into the woods by themselves, like John Muir style, just riding the top of a tree in a thunderstorm, right? And eating stale bread for days. And but if you garden, you know that there, in gardening, there's always this, you're contending with the wild. You're contending with living beings with wills of their own and with rabbits and with beneficial and non-beneficial insects. What is that but wildness? Mm-hmm. And why is there a sense that to write about nature, to talk about nature, nature has to be away and afar and separated from our daily and our domestic and our communities and our families, that that's some other experience. With that separation came what was really deeply disturbing to me, but a convention of an absence of other people in the lives of these people who were truly experiencing nature in the sublime way. It was like, to do that, you had to do it in isolation and in solitude. I don't get to do that. I have a daughter whose company I enjoy. Right? Like, I actually like being around her. I live near to my parents. That's a blessing. I want to be with them and spend time with them. I don't want to have to disappear my people in order to engage with the greater than human world. And more importantly, in the book, I'm really thinking about how dangerous that is, how disassociated that is from the realities that most of us must deal with on a daily basis, from the realities that we need to deal with if we're going to sustainably move forward in healing the damage that has been done to this planet, partially based on that solitary vision and set of ideations. So in the beginning of the Prairie Project, this work isn't easy. This reframing and rethinking isn't easy work. And so over the course of the book, you watch me kind of figure some things out, right? Some of it I knew, or some of it I knew in the frontal cortex, but I wasn't embodied, right? I didn't really figure it out. And so as I began the Prairie Project in the summer of 2019, partially because of my husband Ray's insistence, I have these ideas, and I was like, what we're gonna do is remove the sod and weeds from that part of lawn that nobody ever uses. It was so weedy with thistle that you couldn't even play on it, you know, which is the one reason for a lawn. Like, that's the only purpose for a lawn, is that the kid can play on it. But she couldn't, because she would get the nettles from the thistle. So it was a useless track of land. We're going to remove that sod and plant this pollinator garden, I said, around Mother's Day of 2019. And then the whole summer, my husband's like, when? When is that going to happen? And so one day I was like, I'm calling for the soil. And I just did it. I didn't consult him. I didn't consult the weather. I didn't do anything. And I picked the windiest week of the year. Mm-hmm. And it was two big plots of soil, and so one of them could go in the driveway, but the other one had to go in the street. And the windiest week of the year, and a snowstorm was coming in 2 days. Which is what happens when you don't work in community, right? If I had worked with my husband over the course of the summer when he was trying to help me, that could have happened in a much more convenient time. If I had consulted any kind of expert who would have told me, maybe wait until next week when there's not gale force winds and a snowstorm coming, I could, right? But no, I was like, independent person doing nature. And it doesn't work. Like, I was going to be out thousands of dollars if the snowplows had come, right? Before we got a chance to deal with that soil that was in the street. Being solitary like that isn't helping anyone, even the solitary soul. Yeah. So I wanted to write a different kind of book. I wanted to write a book that incorporated my conversations with my husband and that it talked about what it meant to be educating my daughter during that remote schooling era of 2020 and how that affected what I could do in the garden and what I could. I just wanted to write a book that was honest about the actual complexities of our lives and the actual interconnections that almost all of us live with and figure out how I could have that community and have that network and my relationships and still have a pretty sublimely amazing relationship with nature.
Indeed. And in this book, I feel like you share with us things that we never knew about Camille Dungy. So one that was such a warm and pleasant surprise to me, you being a legacy child of the environmental movement and your great-grandfather being an extension agent at Southern University, the historical Black college and university in Louisiana. So referencing the past there. And then also your in your 20s living in Lynchburg, Virginia and going to the Ann Spencer Garden. And could you talk about how both of those experiences impacted your thoughts and your thought process and just creating your garden, especially as Ann Spencer being an ecological writer like yourself and a poet?
Yeah. Thank you for these questions.
Thank you for being here to answer them. We are so happy. We love you.
Oh, my goodness. You know, you write a book, it's this lonely process. And then community just pops up so that it makes me feel very gratified to be in conversation with a mind like yours. So thank you. In line a little bit with your question about the people who are in my book and your question about Ann Spencer, my great-grandfather, anybody in here training to be a writer, like in an MFA program or working as a writer or anything like that? So we got a few people. Tell me if I'm wrong. Maybe things have changed. But I feel like in my education, in my creative writing and literature classes, there was a lot of importance placed on the role of the solitary genius, right? This individual genius who sort of just pops up out of nowhere and is like no one else who's ever existed. And that's like what you're aiming towards at a certain extent when you're training to be an artist in that particular school of literature. Like you want to be that individual genius who, even if there's a whole kind of school that you're out of, you're the one who's the headliner of that tradition that everybody will think of your name first and eventually only, right? And forgetting all the other people. Like the way we talk about Martin Luther King Jr. as if he just did that. Mm-hmm. It's just him. Without the entire incredible infrastructure of tens of thousands of people working alongside and with that vision, right? But again, over the course of writing this book, I had to retrain myself, much as we do in a garden, that every time the new garden comes out, I gotta like figure out what to do with the hollyhocks this year, because they're not the same hollyhocks they were last year. I have some of the information I know what to do, but it's a little different every time. I worked through this book and would sort of sometimes push against my desire to want to show up like the individual genius in this book. So I was out one day gardening, and I thought, oh, yeah, Ann Spencer. Right? Like, I am not alone. And in fact, being I think I was about 25 years old when I showed up in Lynchburg, Virginia, in my first teaching job, and knew about Spencer because I had a family history in Lynchburg, but really started spending time in her garden and started spending time with her at her son at that time and being steeped in that space. But some 15, 20 years later, I was in my own garden and realized I had to acknowledge in the book, I had to write into the book the way that Ann Spencer's way of building a home outside her home in the garden with, she called them rooms. She separated her garden into little rooms. Her writing cabin was in her garden. My yard's too small for that, but it's goals in the future to right. one day have a writing cabin out there. But also, she didn't just garden. That garden was a space where all of these civil rights workers who came through on that circuit would stay at her home and take respite in her garden. Artists who moved and passed through. So the garden was a space of rest and restoration for Spencer and this whole community, which is also something that I hope for my garden. And that Ann Spencer's garden was an example for me mm-hmm. of how that could be done. Ann Spencer herself, a poet, educator, a librarian, a civil rights activist, one of the founding members of the NAACP in Central Virginia, right? She was this person who was many people, and the garden was one of the centers for strength getting for her. So I realized it was impossible. She's almost in the middle of the book, I think, actually. Yes. I feel like it's almost became impossible for me to write honestly about my experience of having done all these without writing about this incredible foremother mm-hmm. who also did. And while my grandparents also lived in Lynchburg, at a time that coincided with Ann Spencer, and they would leave Lynchburg and drive down to Louisiana to mm-hmm. see my great-grandfather and his land and his experience of being a teacher, or like someone who taught people how to tend the land. That also, I didn't just spring forward like as the first person to do this, not the first person in my family, not the first person in this country, not any of those. And that to me actually feels more exciting mm-hmm. and way less lonely
yeah.
than having to be an individual genius. Like nothing survives all by itself. Nothing does. And so I wanted to build a cluster of beautiful growth around me.
And you definitely did that. And speaking of Ann Spencer and civil rights and politics, you do not shy away from politics in this book. You say their names, and by they, I mean Black people who were murdered in the United States of America through domestic terrorism, through police violence, people like Breonna Taylor, people like George Floyd, people like Elijah McClain in Colorado. And you talk about a moment in August of 2020 where your daughter had named the bunnies, and you and your daughter had named these bunnies. And in that summer, which was such an intense summer, and we still are feeling the ramifications today, you said you weren't surprised that death had come to your door because the bunny, you found one of the bunnies had been killed in the garden. So why was it important for you to do like Ann Spencer and not separate politics from gardening and to speak the uncomfortable truths in this environmental book that you've written, in this memoir?
I'd like to meet a Black person in America who actually could separate those, like, right? I mean, and I don't know anybody who can.
Right.
I happen to have this garden, which is a space that I have built as a space of replenishment and grounding. But even then, I'm often working in the garden very, very aware of those who are not able to find those spaces of grace and comfort because of they're alive, but living in all the different kind of ramifications of systemic racism and disempowerment that makes that very difficult, or they're not alive anymore because of those various ramifications. It's all a part of It's just all a part of my reality. And if I am wanting to write honestly about my reality in the way that I want to include my family and I want to, you know, include community and I want to talk about those things, similarly, it felt impossible to write a book that did not bring in the events that were swirling all around me in 2020. I lived in Colorado, we also had what was at that time the largest wildfire in the history of Colorado came within 10 miles of my house. So, like, in the very beginning of this conversation, I talked about these sort of actual things that also operate metaphorically, like the smoke of the catastrophe of the human, the violence that humans have wrecked in this country was like, it was like the smoke was all around me. Like, I could not breathe for long periods of time that year because of those things. And it just, they showed up in the book. I should also talk a little bit about process, which will help explain part of how it shows up in the book, is I had a really fancy prize that I received in 2019, and the money came in 2020, and I took the year off of teaching, and I was supposed to have a year to write a book. And I was going to write a book about my garden. Like, that had been the idea. This was not the book I thought I was going to be writing, because we got not very far into 2020 and everything shifted, and my daughter came home and I was the one responsible for overseeing her schooling, and then the fire started, and it got to the point where I didn't have very much time at all, and I instituted a practice that I call my 2020-20s. And for 20 minutes a day, every day, I had to write with a writerly, conscious observation of what I was experiencing and what I was doing and seeing and feeling and tasting, etc. And so a lot of this book happened because of those 20 minutes that I had of this is what happened and this is what I saw. And so part of what you're experiencing with the kind of really feeling, what I hope is a intimate experience of my life, is basically you're reading a fancy version of a journal, right? Of my diary. Like, you're really kind of going through my days. And in my days, I'm having to take care of my daughter because she's having a completely justifiable anxiety response to something that has happened in the news or in the world, or I having to decide whether or not to be in the same room with my parents because COVID is also rampant and I don't want to put them at risk, and they're at higher risk because, you know, like, so all of those things end up, if those things didn't show up in the book, I think I would have spent that year not writing. I just had to write what I really saw.
And it does, it very much does feel like, and thank you for sharing your thoughts throughout the book with us. It feels like, I think about W.B. Du Bois and the Souls of Black Folks, and him talking about peeking behind the curtain, and Ida B. Wells speaking to the unvarnished truth. And that's certainly what you did here. And I wanted to talk about the Prairie Project, because this is the roux of the book. If we talk about gumbo, and you and Callie and Ray are the Holy Trinity, the roux is the Prairie Project, your garden. And there were a few plants that came up that really caught my eye, the hollyhocks and the sunflowers. And they caught my eye because I read a lot of historical garden history as it relates to Black America. And these two plants come up very regularly. So could you talk about your hollyhocks and it growing to be taller than you and creeping up to your front door and all those wonderful, lovely, we want to hear about your plants now and your garden, the beautiful nature part.
Yeah. I wonder if one of the reasons you hear about plants like those in the Black gardens is the way that they call for care, right? And they're kind of maybe relative unfussiness. And so if one of the reasons that I have to write if I was going to be writing, I was going to need to be writing about doing the dishes and the laundry and taking care of my daughter and also watching the news and reacting and responding to like the world around me. It's busy. There's like a perpetual busyness inside my brain and my life, which I think reflects the reality of a lot of actual people's lives, mm-hmm. and a reality that feels very different than that fabricated version of engagement with nature where the guy gets to just walk out by himself for a month. Who can do that? I don't know. Right? And so that sort of difference, if that is your life, if your life is sort of that busy as mine is, I don't really have time for fussy plants. Mm-hmm. I just don't, right? Truly. I can't have a plant that needs me out there tending it every day and misting it. No plants that need misting on a daily basis exist in my life, right? I wonder if that's part of the tradition, because Black people are busy in this country, right? We got 3 and 4 jobs, and you got your family, and you got this, and you have to live someplace far away from where you work because of... Like, you don't have time for plants that need fussy maintenance. Sunflowers are amazing, right? They just, like, you just plant those first ones, and then they're like, all right, I know that we are technically annuals, but what we're going to do is just scatter seed.
Yes.
We'll come back year after year after year, way more than you even want. You know, like, that's the sunflowers. And I think, I wonder how much of that exist. And then I write a little bit in one of the sections of the books about the archaeological excavations at Thomas Jefferson's summer home outside of Lynchburg, Virginia. And archaeologists have found all kinds of plants, many of which we understand now as ornamental plants, violets, sunflowers, but which are also edible plants. So the violet leaf can be used as a substitute for okra. Sunflower is incredibly nutritious, right? The oil, the seed, all of these things. And so also I wonder how many of those plants, I don't think hollyhocks are edible in that way, but they're also, they come back, like once they're established, they come back year after year. No matter what you do.
Right.
But so I wonder also how many of those plants that a particular kind of gardening mindset would call ornamental, Black people actually grew because they were also nutritious, right? They were beautiful and functional in that way.
And before we wrap up tonight and get to the audience questions, I know there are many, so I'm going to make sure we stay on time. There was something that really stood out to me in your book, and I remember thinking, this is the blackest garden book I have ever read in my life. And not for the reasons that you all may think, but there was 3 words in there that I mentioned to you that really stood out. You were talking about a woman who walked up to you. You were working in your garden in Oakland, California with your husband, Ray. Y'all were living at the time. And this woman walked up and she had a pressing curl. And Black women, we are so serious about our hair. And I remember thinking, I don't think I've ever seen the words pressing curl in any type of environmental literature. So the fact, I just felt so seen. Because back in the day, before I had my cornrows, I had a press and curl, like hardcore Halle Berry. You know, I think about Easter, my press and curl. So we thank you for that, Camille. We really do. Black women around the world, thank you. So it's just so much joy to see that. So please tell the press and curl story for those that may not.
Yeah. Well, right. So I'm out there. It's Oakland. The freeway's just there. Like, this is not a place where people are expected to be gardening. I was like, I'll just put a little love. Get some discount things from, you know, when they're already almost dead at the nursery, like the $1.50, you know, whatever. Like, they'll die in my ground or they'll grow, whatever. And if they grow, then I've got something else to look at. So I'm out there, and this woman's like, but why? You know? Yeah. Why would you do that? And I was angry, though, because I was like, but why not? Why don't I get to have something beautiful in this place? Why don't I get to be expected to be making that kind of effort. But another piece of it, and I think that this actually also goes to the things that we don't see so much in literature. In the process of writing the book, I wanted to describe people, but I didn't want to just be like my white friend and my black friend, right? Because what does that even mean? This don't mean anything. And so I had a decent amount of proficiency with the black people of being able to describe things about them. But I started doing like some surveys of my white friends. And I'm like, how would you describe your hair? Right? Like what color would you describe that? Or so that I could, you know, what color are those eyes? Like I know the descriptions that I might have, but we know, black people know that the descriptions that other people have for us are not necessarily those that we would use for ourselves. And so that was like a source of conversation for a while with people, just to ask. It was good cocktail party conversation, by the way. If you're like ever in those sorts of situations, like what would you describe about these aspects of yourself? And people sort of enjoy getting to name that. But that meant that I really try throughout the book to describe people in the same kind of way that we might describe varieties of flowers, right? So I know what a rose is, but that doesn't actually tell you anything, right? You don't know like the petal structure on that rose. You don't know how many color patterns, right? Like, so once we actually start talking about a flower in a way that you could see it, you have a careful description. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to have that same kind of nuanced, careful description for the people who showed up in the book. And you got her. I did the press and curl. And you're like, I know everything about this woman.
Right? She's not a gardener with a press and curl. Ain't no way. Well, certainly it is a joy. It is an honor. It is, you're just everything, Camille Dungy. We are just thrilled to have you here. This book is groundbreaking, it is trailblazing, it is a classic, and it certainly will change, I know, the course of environmental literature, in the course of garden writing. So thank you for keeping it so real with us, and thank you for showing us how it's supposed to be done.
Oh, thank you.
You are a living legend, and she deserves the biggest round of applause for being that. We don't see that every day. Thank you.
Thank
we love you.
Thank you so much.
And now we are going to take questions, reflections, comments from the audience. And we have right there in the back.
Hi, Abra. It's Sid. We just spoke.
Sid! Oh, my goodness. Wow. It's a joy to see you.
Yeah, it's a joy to see you, too. I won't take up too much time, but I am completely overwhelmed and just so rejuvenated by meeting Camille and seeing you and knowing about the our place, our garden. I'm a gardener. I've been gardening in one place for about 25 years now. It has been a place of sanctuary for me. I've always thought of myself as just so intensely connected to this process. I'm an artist as well. And so the two activities bring together everything that is so vital to me. It allows family, it allows community, it allows expressiveness, it just answers and just crosses the T's and dots the I of everything in my life that's important. So I'm so happy to have you, Camille, writing on the level that you're writing and acknowledging our way of doing things. I'm a sculptor, and I've done a series of sculptures about individual black farmers and gardeners in the South. Beautiful. And done a number of exhibitions, and the titles are Our Places, More Places of Our Own, thinking about that issue of sanctuary and what the garden means to me as a black woman. And so seeing and being here and listening to this, I feel like you are the hub of so many important spokes and this wheel that I feel like, you know, I have this place that I can locate my soul, myself as an artist, myself as a gardener. So, and having said that, that's my comment, that's my observations, that's my feelings. I also want to announce that my house sits in the middle of my garden, and I am turning that house into a residency for writers.
Ooh.
To come and be in the garden and write. So that's good, and that is coming through the Colored Girls Museum. I don't know if many of you
yes.
know about the Colored Girls Museum. So, you know, Vashti Dubois, Erica Hawkins, Linda Grace, these are all people that are there working with me. I've just designed a garden for them, and so that's going to be another place of sanctuary for an ornamental garden, that a place to come and just find solace and community and love from Black gardeners and women.
Oh, Sid, that's wonderful. Keep in touch with me. I would love to know more and be able to
oh, yes.
spread
you'll,
the
you'll,
word.
You will hear about it. They're going to announce it and send out the information so people can apply, but all are welcome.
And yeah. Sid, will you say your last name so the audience can hear, because you ain't just anybody, Sid. You are a big deal in Philadelphia. You are a treasure to the city, and I want people to make sure they're able to follow you and support your work.
Okay, my name is Sid Carpenter, so you can look me up. There's stuff. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I just off of one of the things that Sid said is so soil is primarily a book-length narrative, prose narrative. But, you hear what Sid just said about, like, this is, it can't be one-dimensional. It can't be homogenous. And writing about creating a robustly diverse space could also not happen for me in just one way. And so there's the prose that moves through the book, but there's also poems that weave through the book. And Abra showed you the maps that are beautiful. And it's like this book cover. When they showed
yes.
me that cover, I was like, thank you. You understand me. They gave her locks, right?
Pictures of your garden in the book, too.
And it's Western plants, but there are also two different kinds of visual image. Photograms that I took clippings from the garden and sent them to the visual artists I worked with, and photographs that either I took or my daughter or my friend Mary Ellen. Mary Ellen came over one day with her fancy camera, and Callie was like, well, that looks like fun, and started like taking pictures with Mary Ellen's camera, and then Callie got her own camera for Christmas that year, and now we don't know who took what pictures, which feels, and then this artist, Dion Lee, who lives in Ohio, I sent her the photographs and the cuttings, and then Dion made these really timeless seeming black and white images with them. So I love that the book has all these other women's hands in them, and also these variety of modes of saying and describing and speaking, which I think is the only way to really fully make this expression of complicated joy that I have in the garden come forward.
Hi, Mrs. Dunshi.
Hello.
So I was wondering, have you ever visited an orchard, like a fruit field? And if so, how was your experience?
I have actually a number of orchard experiences. I grew up in Southern California, where there were a lot of citrus fields. And so they were just trees growing fruit around all the time. Also in California, when you leave California, it's like one of the sad, this is truly, I will never get over the loss of lemon trees just all over the neighborhood. You know, when we lived in Oakland, I used to be able to tell my husband which house's tree to go to for the level of tartness of lemon I wanted.
Wow.
You know? There were like five different lemon trees. One was really sweet and one was super tart. And depending on what it was that I was aiming for, go over to Shannon's house and get me a couple of those, right? And everybody's fine. You can go get the lemons because they had so much you needed to have the fruit. So that's a way that I have understood orchards, that it's not this kind of monocrop rows of only having that one plant and somebody bringing the bees to just pollinate them and leaving them. They're just kind of wild, essentially, in the people's yards. But also the fruit orchards. And then I had a chance, which I write about in passing, I had a chance to go to John Muir's house in Martinez, California, in Northern California. And he had some orchards. Also, they were pecan. And those are beautiful. When those are in bloom, they're really, really something special. And then in New England, I lived on the East Coast for about 11 years. And in New England, I've been to a few, like, apple orchards and pear orchards and things. Why are you asking, though? So aren't there, because Ross Gay has that famous poem, right, about the corner of 9th and Christian in Philadelphia, right? And there's the fig tree. But isn't there a small orchard project someplace here in Philadelphia? Talk to these people. Find out.
Philadelphia Orchard Project at the Woodland Cemetery at 40th and... Where did the 40th trolley stop? 40th and Woodland. And they have a big teaching orchard, so you can just walk through it. But they have apples and pears. They have goji berries. They have pawpaw trees. And they plant other plants among them, so they don't just look like a monocrop with rows. There's beneficial plants and things like that that grow.
Yay!
Can you talk about a little bit more about your writing process? I'd love to hear, you know, now that this book is done, kind of where is your mindset now? Are you still writing? Kind of how do you, is it still that 20-minute process, or kind of where's your mind at this point?
I'm not as rigidly 20 minutes a day, every day, right now. But I write really regularly, but I don't know what I'm doing at this point. I'm back to the let's see what shows up stage of things, which is an exciting place. Once I figure out what shows up, there is there's a regularity that I need to have. I trained as a musician early in my life. And I was also, as I'm sure you can tell by looking at me, a competitive athlete. And in both of those worlds, there's a whole part of your training that has nothing to do with performance. And it really has nothing to do with even, you know, playing a final piece of it. It's running the chords. It's just like practicing your chord progressions and your scales and doing finger exercises or doing wall squats for the athletic stuff. It's like, it doesn't look like what the game day looks like. So a lot of my writing right now is just scale running wall squats. right now, it doesn't look anything like anything that you will ever see, but I need to stay limber. I need to keep those muscles toned. I need to be able to pay attention so that when the time comes where I do start to know what the, I'm just going to stick with the metaphor, what the competition season is going to look like, then I'm still ready and I'm still in shape. So that's where I am. But for this book, it started, by the time I had the Guggenheim Fellowship, I knew I was writing a book about my garden. The 20-minute exercises allow me to continue to do that while my daughter was at home. And then I was able to eventually kind of pull those together and create a structure and a map of what would happen. It sounds really easy, but you're reading what's the 9th whole revision of that book. I not just wrote and rewrote, typed and retyped
wow.
that book multiple times. And I also have to give, again, I have to give a shout out to community, because I had really wonderful alpha readers who worked with me and pushed back at me. I have a fantastic editor, and it was a joy to work with a Black editor who could sometimes be like, go further, you know? Yeah. Why are you being, like, don't hold back on this. And that was really, really wonderful to work with you, Dawn, to have somebody who really fundamentally got me and did not let me pull back or not really be clear about how I felt. I mean, I do still have to live in that town, right? You know, yeah. So there were times where I was like, do I, you know, I let me just like not quite say this directly. You're not friends with that person anyway. No, actually, it's a good town is the thing. Like, it's a good town. I have lots of really good friends and community members, and most everything that I say about that place where I live could apply to almost any other place in this country.
Yeah.
It's just that happens to be the place that I live, that happens to be the details. So I don't know if I answered your question about writing process, but I tried.
You did.
Okay.
And I don't know if you're aware, maybe you are, Camille, that Philadelphia, Greater Philadelphia, is the garden capital of America with, I believe it's 34 public gardens within 30 miles of each other. And here tonight are people who are members of the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society team, Chanticleer Gardens, Morris Arboretum, and Longwood Gardens in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. And I say that because you all have libraries and bookstores and places that you sell things. So it is wonderful that Camille is here, but we must financially support and invest in her book and make sure that it is front and center right by your register at your garden so that the world can see this book. And to the OGCBPV, the Our Garden Club of Philadelphia and Vicinity, we would love your story as well. The world needs to hear it because it is an incredible one. So, Camille, you have the last word. We thank you so much for being here tonight.
Thank you all for coming and for your questions and your attention and for being here for what's the first official event that I've had for Soil. So I will always and forever have an even more special place in my heart for Philadelphia. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.